He's the author of Reversing Heart Disease, Reversing Diabetes, Reversing Health Risks, has a newsletter out that is really a slick piece of material. Lots of great education in this newsletter. We'll tell you how to get that and how to get the books, and also we'll tell you a little bit about his new book. I'd like to welcome to our show Dr. Julian Whitaker. Julian?
Hi, nice to be with you, John.
Good to have you on the air again. I when I see your newsletter come across my desk, I say, now there is a man that's really making progress. That's a slick piece of information you got there. How'd you go about deciding to do that?
Well, there's a large company in Potomac, Maryland that publishes consumer newsletters. They wanted to do some things in health, and I met with them last spring and told them that I felt that we can do one on health and also kind of the problems that the medical profession finds itself in at using therapies that don't work and that are expensive, and so we did that, and the newsletter's grown very rapidly, which I think is an indication that the general public is kind of in the dark. I think they're beginning to lose trust in the so-called technological approach to diseases, their experience with that particular high-tech, low-humane, non-nutritional, kind of insane approach to a lot of our problems has created some doubt as to the efficacy of it, and so they're looking for some alternatives and a new voice.
Do you think the public's getting wise? You think they've been beat up enough? You think they've been overcharged enough and hurt enough that they're
They certainly would be if they were reasonable about the medical profession. You know, I can't imagine the run that bypass surgery and angioplasty have had, and those guys still outside walking around. I think they ought to be in jail myself.
Every year it gets more popular. I mean, every year they do a bigger business, and every year the studies come out and say that this does not save lives. Yeah, that's right. And it's a phenomenon. Somebody's got to write a book just about how something as not just useless but harmful as bypass surgery and angioplasty can become such a great business.
I just delivered that book to Simon & Schuster 2 weeks ago.
Oh, did you? There you go.
Yeah, it's called, the book is The Heart Surgery Trap and How to Stay Out of It.
Oh, that'll be a good one. I hope you get a good read on it, to say the least. I wish we could get some controversy. I mean, with this business about healthcare costs and concern about delivering healthcare to the majority of people, and we have such a big sink that people are throwing money in terms of heart disease surgery, I mean, I wish somebody would just get wise and say, hey, you know, this Star Wars medicine that's going on has got to stop. We've got multi-billion dollars right there that we could spend on useful things.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody's wise enough, are they?
Well, actually, I think they are.
Good. I want to hear some encouragement. Bring me up today.
I think that, number one, the interest in my newsletter seems to indicate that people are definitely looking into other areas. ABC News down here is carrying, features on alternative medicine. Frankly, I don't practice alternative medicine. I try to practice good medicine. I don't see that I need to brand myself as a holistic or alternative, because it's an alternative to what? Basically, if people have problems, I try to find the most reasonable solution for those problems, and often those seem to be quote alternative therapies, like lifestyle change, low fat diet, exercise, and that's not alternative, that's just good sense.
Conservative therapies. You know, what's kind of interesting is we have the National Board of Nazi police. That governs the doctors in the state out chasing people who don't practice in line, and yet here they've got this whole business of bypass surgery that has been shown not to save lives. They've got these oral hypoglycemic diabetic pills that read in heavy black print there's a 2.5 times risk of dying of heart disease.
They've got
the treatment of high blood pressure, which is for 95% of the people has been shown to be a failure, and yet they're out chasing quacks who are teaching people how to eat well and live well, and they're missing the forest for the trees.
Well, I think also and it will get worse. I just talked with an attorney who's involved in some of these things and pointed out that the attorney general has upped the state has upped the attorney general status to 50 people to investigate physicians. Now, there are about 75,000 practicing California physicians. And we have 50 attorney generals monitoring their behaviors. Now, if you were to equate the attorney general physician ratio at 50 per 100,000 to the district attorney general population ratio that is going after rapists and white collar and blue collar crime and murderers and assault and gangs. You know, they have something like 75 per 10 million. And now we have 50 per 275,000.
Well, you got to get those doctors, you know, I mean, after
all. And the thing, I believe, the thing that interests me about this, I think this is reflective of the dissatisfaction or the pressures that are on the health care business, because everybody says if things are so bad, as Time Magazine says they are, and as Newsweek says they are, and as we read about it in the front pages of the paper, et cetera, about the health care delivery system collapsing and 30 million people without health insurance, and the health care cost has gone up 200% in 10 years, where the consumer price index has gone up 60%. If things are so bad, then it must be the physician's fault, and if that, and therefore we're kind of drawing straws to throw out a bunch of attorney generals to make it look like the state is acting in a responsible manner. But the problem that with that whole approach is not the physicians as it is the system. It is the system of the way physicians are educated. It is the physicians where they're taught to be biased against anything except drugs and surgery. It is the entire system of that that is the problem, not the physicians themselves. But then physicians can't be, you know, held totally blameless in this situation, because it is they who perpetuate the system, you know, and can't understand that they themselves have been brainwashed. That's my opinion of it.
Well, also, it's a system that is rewarded, you know, for doing things to people, not rewarded for getting them well. I mean, so what the consumer wants is the consumer wants better health, but what the doctor's providing is more treatment.
Right.
And so, you know, I can't see a change. I can't see, unless somebody sticks their head above the crowd and says, look, there's the problem is we're not delivering effective therapy. What we're doing is we're just delivering therapy, and we're just charging for it until somebody stands up and says there's a better way to do things. I can't see a change, and I can't see the health care costs decreasing. As a matter of fact, I listen to the politicians talk about how they're going to have a new health care system. All they're talking about is just a new insurance company for physicians to steal from. They're not talking about any particular reform that's going to decrease the sickness in this country. They're not talking about covering people who really need to have coverage. They're not talking about limiting therapies that aren't effective, like we've discussed, bypass surgery, delivering diabetic pills and all other kinds of medications that are considered questionably effective or ineffective. They're not dealing with the underlying issues.
No, I don't think they are either. And I don't think that will be where it will. That ultimately has to be where it comes from, but I think the public has to, in some way, dictate to politicians what to do. And generally, the public dictates to politicians in what to do based upon money they give to politicians or lobbyists that they pay to control it. And you don't find any more higher paid lobbyists than are provided by the California Medical Association and the American Medical Association in determining governmental policy. So even though that is where it may ultimately come from, the forces are going to keep the current structure in place almost indefinitely, as far as I can see. Because those of us who are involved in a different approach, we don't have the money or the political nature to, we're not out to protect a vested interest, so to speak. The general physicians are out to protect, and the political activists and the orthodox physicians are out protecting vested interest, and those of us who are simply doing our job as physicians are basically, we're just trying to help people out, and the political process is more or less abhorrent to us rather than an ally. I don't think that'll change anytime soon, but it might. I don't know.
My guest is Dr. Julian Whitaker. He's from, is it Huntington Beach or Newport Beach now?
Newport Beach.
Newport Beach, California. And people who want your books, Reversing Heart Disease, Reversing Diabetes, Reversing Health Risks, can find them in any bookstore. All you have to do is just kind of push them out of the way so that you can see my books, as your books are usually on top of my books. And they're very popular books, to say the least. But tell me a little bit about the new book on the heart disease business.
Well, the book's called The Heart Disease, The Heart Surgery Trap, and basically it's an updated version of Reversing Heart Disease, only it's a little more pointed and a little more descriptive of the nature of the growth of bypass surgery and angioplasty, and how they were not really intended for improvement of people's health and how it's mostly financially oriented. And the scientific studies are so powerful refuting the assumptions on those therapies that I'm surprised they're legal, much less that they're growing. And basically, for the heart surgery industry, which it definitely is, it's certainly an industry now to survive, it has to provide and to do hundreds of thousands of unnecessary procedures. Not just a few, but hundreds of thousands of procedures which are obviously, to anyone who really knows the literature, unnecessary. Now, there are about 10% of the procedures done for bypass surgery which one would deem necessary, or rather appropriate. There's always alternatives, but at least it's appropriate. At least the studies show that there's a reasonable expectation of benefit, a slight expectation of improved survival rate. But for about 80 to 90%, all it is just dishonest fear tactics scaring people into a procedure that they don't need. I think that basically 50% of the people who are having these procedures, both bypass and angioplasty, don't even have chest pain. They're told they need it to save their lives, and that just, in my opinion, is just a lie.
Well, what do you tell the patient who comes from a doctor and says, well, I just saw my doctor, and my doctor said if I don't have bypass surgery, I won't live to see tomorrow?
Well, I listed actually in the newsletter, in the January issue of the newsletter, I told people how to get a second opinion. And in that newsletter, I outline what is necessary for the evaluation. And when I evaluate a patient for that nature, I will put it through a stress test, an echocardiogram. I'll look at the blockages that are the report of the blockages, talk to him about his pain, etc. And using non-invasive techniques, you can classify a patient as to cardiac risk. Most of the time, the patient's cardiac risk, that is the risk of having a heart attack over the next year, is between 1 out of 100 and 1 out of 200. Generally, you have a very healthy population being funneled into this, and I can show them the studies to show that their risk without surgery of dying from a heart attack is 1 out of 100. I can then show them that the average risk for bypass surgery in the state of California was 1 out of 17. So that the death rate or the risk of the therapy is much higher than the risk of the disease. I then point out that even if they survive the disease, the therapy, that the heart attack rate and the death rate is still there as it was before and, in fact, is increased. The 10-year follow-up on the CAS showed that the surgical group did worse at 10 years in terms of heart attacks and deterioration than the medical group. So when they're given the right data, you know, they understand that, and they generally do not proceed with the therapies. However, one of the major problems that we deal with is the indelible effect of the fear tactic that is used by the cardiologist. For the last 10 years, I've known that cardiologists create more cardiac cripples than the disease ever will create. Because when you tell someone they're a walking time bomb or they're going to die at any minute, they never, ever forget that. And when they don't forget that, they have to walk around with that, and to try to eliminate that from their psyche is almost impossible because they will always have that. And I've never figured out why the medical profession, which is supposed to be humane, uses that kind of tactic knowing the effect that has upon the person's psyche.
Well, I mean, after all, the only way you can relieve the psychological depression of thinking that you're going to die is to undergo the surgery.
Yeah, and then they feel like they've been cured.
They feel like they've been cured. I no longer have heart disease. As a matter of fact, to prove it, and to prove they don't have to worry about it anymore, and that the bypass is such a wonderful operation, they serve them bacon and eggs the next morning for breakfast and pork chops that night for dinner. They are now invincible.
Crazy.
Yep. So anyway, what you're saying is that you have about a 6% chance of dying if you have the surgery. You have about a half to a 1% chance of dying per year if you avoid the surgery. We're talking about an average type of situation. How about the patient who comes in and says, well, my doctor told me that that there's less than a half a percent chance of me dying from the surgery and no risk involved. In fact, very minimal risk. We do these things every day. Is the patient setting themselves up for any risks?
Well, I point out that what most of the community hospitals do is that they quote the death rates from the major surgical centers that have death rates as a part of clinical trials or published studies. And in general, when major surgical centers have death rates as part of clinical trials, they put their best foot forward, and they do record the lowest death rates of 1%. The death rate in the CAS study, which was the best study provided, was a 1% death rate. However, for the community hospital physician to quote that death rate is similar to high school basketball team saying that we can play as good as the Lakers. And that is just not true. The average death rate in the state of California average is 5.73%. I recently was talking to a cardiologist, and I quoted that 5.73% in the newspaper as the average death rate. And he wrote to the newspaper, it says, this is not nearly, the death rate is not nearly so high as Dr. Whitaker would lead you to believe. And I was just quoting a fact. And in talking to him, the death rate in his hospital was 6%. It was higher than the average. And I'm sure that he tells his patients that his death rate is very, very low, 1%, when in reality is 6%. So in general, the death rates in the best of hands is between 1 and 3%. And then it goes up from there. And most, since most people have their operations by an average cardiologist, because that is a surgeon, that is the definition of such, then the death rate is going to be in the 5% range.
Patient sitting in front of the doctor. The doctor puts up this x-ray, and there's this big plaque sitting there. It's 80, 90% closed, and the patient's having chest pain from it. I mean, what kind of an argument could you give to that patient to
I show them the studies, and I show them that the blockages really don't matter, and they don't. I talked to Thomas Grayboys just yesterday, and he's getting an article published where he had 165 patients that were recommended to have an angiogram. And out of that 165 patients, he told only 20% of them to have the angiogram. 80% of them he told not to have the angiogram. So he's not even looking at the blockages in 80% of the people he sees. In an additional study with I think 85 patients who had had the angiogram and were told to have bypass surgery based upon the blockage, he told 85% of them, or 74, not to have the surgery, and didn't even look at the angiogram in a method of assessment. The angiographic blockages are irrelevant most of the time.
Now, isn't that because it's not the 70, 80, 90% lesions that kill? It's the tiny 40%?
The 70 to 80, 90 lesions, they don't kill if you have an ejection fraction which is greater than 50%. If the ejection fraction, or the actual assessment of heart health, which is a prognosis, if you have good heart health and you have minimal symptoms, you can have 3 90% blockages in the three major coronary arteries and still do quite well, because the heart is building collateral circulation. It can take up oxygen more efficiently. It can protect itself. It's when you have an unhealthy heart that the blockages may play a role, and that is assessed by the ejection fraction. So basically, the coronary anatomy, which drives the business and drives the cardiologist, is not a useful prognostic sign in over 80 to 90% of the people who are having the procedures. But it is that anatomy, which they show up and come around with white coats and they show all the blockages, which is so terrifying to the patients. And I'm sure, Mike, the question that comes to me, which will come to you, is, can you reverse that blockage that my cardiologist showed me on the x-ray?
Bob, thanks for holding on. You're on with Dr. Whitaker.
Yes, Dr. Whitaker, I heard a very confusing report on the radio the other day, and then I saw it on television. I believe it was Saturday on a program for doctors, et cetera, et cetera. But it was talking about cholesterol, and it seemed to indicate that the people who have low cholesterol, which I have, and it's very low, it's exceptionally low, and I've been dieting and eating pretty well. And I thought that I was pretty well out of the woods, and this thing kind of shook me up, because this guy says, oh, well, cholesterol don't mean much, providing this high glyceride or something like that. These people are still subject to heart attacks and cancer of the intestines and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I just wondered about that. And on top of that, they had another report that said in effect that the stuff you take to go to the bathroom, I can't remember the name, diuretics, would eventually cause diabetes. And I hear so many of these false reports. It is quite disturbing. And you know, you hear them on the radio every day, and I wish you could set the record straight.
What do you think about the comments, Dr. Whitaker, that having a low cholesterol is not to your advantage, that it may increase your risk of dying of heart disease?
Well, it obviously does increase your risk of dying of heart disease.
Well, how about to increase your risk of dying of cancer?
Well, that has been published, and the increase in risk of cancer, I think it was with colon cancer, was very slight. And I think in some people, they might have a fat-soluble malabsorption problem, which may contribute to the very low cholesterol. But you've got to remember that these low cholesterol associations with colon cancer were in men and women who were eating the American high cholesterol, high fat diet, yet had exceptionally low cholesterols. If you look at the countries that are eating vegetarian diets and have a diet-induced nationwide low cholesterol, you have almost no colon cancer rate. So it's an aberration there, and the aberration might be that the individuals that are eating the high-fat diet and have a very, very low cholesterol level or have an absorption difficulty with fat-soluble vitamins such as beta-carotene or vitamin E, and that this might indeed be one of the markers for that defect, which the defect is the cause. But if you have a low cholesterol level from eating right, then you've got very low chances of colon cancer, much lower than the native population.
How about the comment about diuretics causing diabetes? Any truth to that?
I've been pointing that out for years. And it's listed in the PDR, the physician's desk reference, thiazide diuretics are associated with diabetes. There's no question about that.
So these people out there in the listening audience who are taking hydrochlorothiazide, diazide, other kinds of diuretics to reduce their risk of dying of heart disease may not be doing so and may be increasing their risk of diabetes. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that's been shown in several studies.
Why is it listed
in the physician's desk reference. And there are just other alternatives to that kind of approach.
Well, let's talk about some of the alternatives. What can people do who have heart disease, who have these blockages, who have chest pain, who are being threatened by the bypass surgeon to have bypass surgery? I suppose the first thing is to figure out whether the threats have any truth to them or not. But after you figure that out and you look at your real statistics and the fact that you're not going to die before the sun sets, how do you get yourself out of trouble? How do you deal with these blockages?
You do it with a diet. Very similar to the one that we've been advocating for years, which is about 10 to 15% fat, mostly vegetable food, limited saturated fat to as low as possible, limited cholesterol. That's where you start. And then you go from there, I personally like to use a lot of vitamins and minerals. I know you and I part company with that, but there was a study recently in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, a European study where they measured the risk of various markers for heart disease in a prospective retrospective analysis, and they found that low levels of vitamin E were 69% predictive of a heart attack in the group that had the low levels. High cholesterol was 29% predictive, and high blood pressure was 25% predictive. So actually, low levels of vitamin E was about over twice as predictive of a heart attack as were high cholesterol or high blood pressure. When they took high cholesterol, high blood pressure, low vitamin E, and low beta carotene, they were 89% predictive. So based upon that, I don't go around measuring everybody's vitamin E level. I just say take 400 to 800 units a day, and which is, I think, based upon that study, is probably one of the cost-effective, easiest lifestyle changes you can do to get the vitamin E level up. And I don't know that you can get it too high with 400 to 800 international units a day, but you will certainly have an effect upon the blood level at that intake. And so that's one thing which I've been recommending people to do for some time now.
I'd like to know there is still hope for me. You didn't see the newsletter I put out about 4 months ago. It had to do with ways of lowering cholesterol in, quote, natural manners.
Uh-huh.
And I used such things as garlic, as a dry form of vitamin E, as 2 grams of C, as oat bran, charcoal.
You added 2 grams of C?
Isn't that amazing?
John McDougal.
I know. There's hope for everybody there, Julian Whitaker, I tell you. Yes, I did. But these are only real sick people, I want you to know. I think there's some value there. You know, the problem that I have with using any kind of medications is that too many folks out there are of the mind that what they need to do is take medicines as opposed to changing their diet and lifestyle. And I know you come out very strongly against that. The most important thing, the foundation, is to get the diet straight and the exercise and the habits straight, and then you use the medication, whether it's doctor-prescribed or over-the-counter or health food-prescribed vitamins. Use that as second-line medicine. Would that be fair?
That's fair. Exactly.
Yeah, because you want to deal with the underlying causes first. All that carbohydrate that you're going to feed these people, isn't it going to cause diabetes?
No. You know, it was demonstrated 60, 70 years ago. That was what first got me interested in low carbohydrate diet back in 1973. A high carbohydrate diet in 73 was reading a monograph by Nathan Pritikin on some of the early work with diet in the treatment of diabetes. Common wisdom is that carbohydrates bring on diabetes, when in reality that was disproven back in 1927. Basically, the carbohydrates that you eat will dramatically enhance the sensitivity your body has to insulin, and with an enhanced sensitivity to insulin, you have lower blood sugar levels with lower insulin levels. And that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine 1971, 22 years ago. And that was with an 85% carbohydrate diet. So if ever there was a lack of foundation for carbohydrates being diabetogenic, it is, that has been disproven 60 years ago. Basically, that is the best program you can have for a diabetic individual, is the high carbohydrate, low fat diet. And I've used that for, as you have, for 17 years now in the treatment of diabetes.
I have occasional diabetics who I give them my best shot. I walk them around. I get them to lose weight. Or they already come in thin, and I put them on a healthy diet. And I know many of them follow the diet very strictly because they're under my supervision at the clinic. And yet still, some of my adult-type diabetics, I cannot get their blood sugars under what would be considered reasonable control, like, say, below 200. Some of them are running 300, 400 blood sugars. You have any hints, extra kinds of therapies that you add that might help those patients?
Well, there's something I've been using, and I'm not sure how successful it is, but there are several studies that were coming out of Canada with vanadyl sulfate. And the studies on the animals have indicated that vanadyl sulfate simply makes both forms of diabetes just disappear. They're quite remarkable. The doses used in the animals in which they had both a pancreatic diabetic induction and also a poisoning of the diabetic cells was about 50 milligrams per kilogram. However, the dosage I'm using total is about 50 milligrams of vanadyl sulfate, which is an over-the-counter nutrient. Small amounts of vanadium are even in Centrum vitamins. I don't know what it's doing there. I've never seen it in any other ones, but it's in Centrum. But it's a very small amount. But at 50 milligrams or so of vanadyl sulfate, in some people it helps to lower the blood sugar level. In others, it doesn't. There's also an additional, use a lot of magnesium in diabetics. I try to get them to take in magnesium shots. I give it to them by mouth. I give it to them to the level where they have diarrhea from it. Because of all the nutrients, the diabetic will lose magnesium. And magnesium is associated with diabetic blindness even more vigorously, low magnesium levels even more vigorously than diabetic control. So I will supplement with magnesium, and it is associated with diabetic control as well. So magnesium we use a lot of.
How about chromium?
And chromium. And I use about 400 micrograms of chromium. The form I use is a chromium picolinate. I don't use massive doses of chromium. Some people use massive. I don't do that. And this is clinical, but I think most of the studies show there are 200 to 400 micrograms of chromium, and I use the picolinate form, is quite biologically active, and you can get some effect there.
None of
the animal or human studies have even come close to the power of vanadyl sulfate in animal studies.
But the question I have, and it's an important one for me, is when you apply this, when you give the vanadyl sulfate and the chromium and the magnesium, on top of a healthy diet and a good exercise program and a trim body weight, do you see further benefit in these people? Do you see better control of their blood sugar?
In some people, there's no question I do. There was one individual in which the agent itself was beneficial because his blood sugar level dropped sequentially every month for about 6 months down to almost normal. And he was also on a healthy diet, or supposed to be, but he never lost weight. And in general, when people are supposed to do this kind of diet, they always lose weight, so I can only assume that he was not on the diet because his weight did not come down. He stayed around 220 for the entire 6 months. And so I can assume from that he was not eating the way I've been telling him to do, as I'm sure you've found a lot of your patients that you may tell them to do that, but they really don't do it. And a marker for their compliance, at least in my office, has been weight loss, because if they do this, they will lose weight. We've had people lose 100 pounds in a year in doing it. And then they stop and they begin to gain weight, and then you can only assume that their dietary change, their fat restriction has laxed. In his case, I think the Vanadale seemed to have done something very beneficial. Others, I've seen that as well. Without weight loss, the addition of Vanadale and these other nutrients had improved their clinical response.
Probably one of the greatest handicaps to getting your message out is people ignore you. Do you find much controversy? Do you find people standing up and saying, you know, Dr. Julian Whitaker, you have no business at all saying that bypass surgery is a huge business. It shouldn't be done in 90% of the cases. And people who do such surgery ought to be put up for trial and put in prison?
Well, I don't really say they ought to be put in prison. I think that, but I don't come out and...
Well, what do you say there? You say it's illegal. They break the law.
I think that...
Something to that effect.
There's so much data against the current usage of it that the public really is unprotected by any element. It's unprotected by the medical profession. It's unprotected by the legal profession because they want a hands-off situation on the medical business. It's unprotected by the lay press because the only thing they want to report are some kind of miracles that make everybody feel warm and fuzzy that we're making progress. So basically there is no check or balance on the behavior within this extremely large industry.
Well, does anybody fight with you about it? I want to know, do you find...
As a matter of fact, no.
Well, isn't that a problem? If somebody would come on this show and say, Dr. Whitaker, you got your figures all wrong, you know, that bypass surgery is doing wonderful good for people, wouldn't you feel better about that?
Well, I would feel better if they would try to, but no one ever really tries. It's almost as if they either consider the attack upon the industry as insignificant, or they consider it something that they really can't defend against. And I think it might be the latter of the two, because the figures are really quite easy to acquire. I've said for years that a junior high math student could find enormous fraud in this industry just by looking at what has been published by the industry's own publications. And that has never really been challenged. I think the things that are often challenged in so-called alternative movements are, you know, therapies or approaches that you have to accept on faith that don't really have the scientific backup, or where you can point to a reference of scientific backup the way you can with nutrition and diet and exercise, and on the good hand and on the bad hand with the bypass surgery. And I think that those are often attacked because they're so vulnerable. But in really kind of refuting, you know, what I've been saying, they have to refute their own data. And that's very, very difficult for someone to do, and most people don't try.
I have patients who come to me who have, again, they've been confronted with the fact that they have lesions in their arteries. And, of course, most people over the age of 30 have lesions, atherosclerotic plaques in their arteries. And they put up these films and they say, well, look at this plaque here. This could lead to a heart attack. This thing could close down on you. And so what we're going to do is tomorrow morning we're just going to wiggle you into a room, and we're going to take this little tube in there. We're just going to pop a few of these things with this balloon. Very simple, very safe, no problem at all. You get up and go home tomorrow.
Right.
What would you tell somebody that was fed that kind of a sales pitch?
I know. I've heard that too. I never really get used to it. I never can see. You know, I never... it shocks me sometimes. Every day. I've been hearing that stuff for almost 15 years now, and it really never fails to surprise me.
Angioplasty. Angioplasty is a huge, huge business. 235,000 angioplasties every year done by the cardiologists.
I think it's more than that. I think it's approaching over 300,000.
Oh, well, it's a great business. In this time of healthcare cost problems, it's a good thing we have a surgery like this that can make great money for the physicians. Depression is right around the corner for everybody, but I don't think it's going to hit the medical business. We have got everybody so buffaloed into believing that what we do works. And we've got most people so convinced that diet and lifestyle are relatively useless procedures that, hey, we're not going to suffer a bit from the depression. So does it work or doesn't it work, angioplasty?
No, I don't think it works at all. And I think the thing that I point out in my book is that you could have given the heart surgeons the benefit of the doubt when they began to promote heart surgery, because at that time no one really knew the death rate of the bypass candidate. With the publications of the Veterans Hospital study, it took everybody by surprise, because here we found these bypass candidates with blockages that were dying only 4% a year. And then in 1983, the death rate was only 1% a year. So that took people by surprise that both medical therapy and the general death rate of the bypass candidate was so low. No one realized that. Angioplasty doesn't have a leg to stand on because they roll this piece of garbage out when they know it can't work. You cannot have an invasive therapy in a patient population that has a sub 2% death rate when the therapy itself has a 2% death rate. That's an impossibility. So there is no justification for angioplasty. The only reason it was rolled out was finances. And when these things start to reclosing at 40%, they don't throw the technology away. They roll out additional technology. And then when they find out that the additional technology doesn't work, they roll out additional technology. So there's this never-ending sequence of being funded for failure. And it's crazy. The angioplasty should never have been done because there was no possibility in any reasonable man's mind that proliferation of that procedure would do anything but bad. The second thing is the angioplasty will never be studied versus control therapy. The reason it can't be studied and it will always be an unproven therapy is because you cannot do a controlled trial when death rate is so low. To show that angioplasty reduces the death rate 30%, when your death rate is only 1% per year, you need something like 1,400 people in the study, and you need to follow them for 6 years, and that is practically an impossibility. So it'll never be proven to work because it is untestable.
But it's a great business.
Well, it is a good business, right?
And unfortunately, as you and I know, and I hope you're right, the public is finding out, is the medical business is a huge business. And the results of that business are published, and people like you and I look at those results, and we try and share them with other folks. And I bet they sit back there in disbelief, and they say, "How in the world?" Just like one, you know, some people I was talking to yesterday, they said, "How in the world could anybody get away with this? It's not fair." But they're doing it, aren't they?
Yeah, I know they do.
Well, I'll tell you, this has been a very, very interesting hour, as it usually is with you, Dr. Julian Whitaker. Your books, again, are Reversing Heart Disease, Reversing Diabetes, Reversing Health Risks, the newsletter that people can get simply by calling 1-800-775-005. And then get a hold of you by calling 714-851-1550. I hope a whole bunch of cardiologists and bypass surgeons call you up tonight and tell you that you're wrong.
Well, dialogue or so-called science or any kind of level playing field they wish.
Well, we'll try and get them on the show. I want to thank you again for being my guest.